Okay, are we ready to proceed? The question was asked, which was really a good question, as to why is it that acne is predominantly on the face? And I said, you know, it's on the back and it's on the chest, etc., but it's never on the thigh, for example. And it may very well be that part of the answer, it's not the total answer, is the amount of sebum. It's also the distribution of microflora. You normally don't have oily legs. If you just think about it, okay? Don't get too carried away, okay? Feeling down there. Versus oily skin. And it may be the amount of sebum that's produced that leads to higher incidence on the skin. Okay, let me tell you where we have been, and then we're going to move forward. We have looked at the first group of drugs, tetracyclines, that target protein synthesis, and we said protein synthesis in bacteria. What we're going to focus on is translation of that message into protein. And now we're going to look at another class of drugs, and that is a class known as macrolide antibiotics. And the prototype, not the only, but the sort of the poster child drug here, is a drug called erythromycin. All of these drugs have some structural features in common. And that is, they are all large ringed molecules, typically a 14-membered large cyclic structure. And off of that cyclic structure are various sugar molecules. And that cyclic structure, that macrolide, is kept together, connected, by means of a cyclic ester that's known as a lactone. And that lactone is susceptible to acid hydrolysis, somewhat analogous to beta-lactams. So this ester, when it is cleaved, gives rise to breakdown products that are one inactive and two irritants. The other feature of this molecule is contained in the various sugars that are attached to it. And again, here's another classic example of an incredibly water-soluble molecule made by a bug to get an advantage against other bugs. And this sugar here has two sites. It has an amino site and it has an alcohol here. And this sugar can be chemically modified. That is, the R1 here can be esterified, so you have various esters here, and the amine group here can lead to the production of various salts. Both conversion to by esterification or chemical modification here and or here leads to compounds, leads to formulations of erythromycin that are more stable to acid breakdown. And so there are various formulations of erythromycin, stearate or estylate or ethyl succinate, derivatives of the parent drug. Macrolide antibiotics have a spectrum similar to that of penicillins. Erythromycin frequently is an alternative to penicillins in a penicillin hypersensitive individual. Its spectrum of activity is primarily gram-positive with a select number of gram-negative organisms. So the question then becomes, how does it work? And why is it selectively toxic? And here's how it works. The drug binds to the 50S subunit of the bacterial ribosome. And in fact, we know a fair amount about its binding. Let me just fire this up. We know that it binds, or its binding involves the 23S RNA fragment that is one of the components of the 50S ribosomal subunit. And its binding involves an adenine residue in this 23S RNA. So the binding site has been somewhat characterized. It binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit. Its binding is associated with this 23S RNA fragment, and the binding involves an adenine residue in that fragment. So it binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit. It binds reversibly, which means that macrolides are bacteriostatic antibiotics. Well, what's the result of that binding? Hola here. Let me just... The result of the binding. So the drug binds, erythromycin binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit, the larger of the subunits. And the result of that binding to the 23S RNA fragment, the result of the binding here blocks the ability of the ribosome to translocate. The translocation step in message translation or in elongation is inhibited. Thus, protein synthesis ceases as long as the drug is present. Decrease the blood level of the drug, binding reverses, and protein synthesis continues. Now, resistance to erythromycin occurs two ways. One is acquired. In fact, they're both acquired. But one involves the ability of the drug or the ability of the organism to actively pump the drug, efflux the drug out of the cytoplasm. Very analogous to tetracyclines. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, self, why is it that these bacteria have these efflux pumps? Because they're trying to survive in an environment that exposes them to a lot of garbage. And one way to survive is to pump the garbage out before these various chemicals that are being produced by other microorganisms do in the organism. So erythromycin, one mechanism for its resistance is it is one organisms that are resistant, one way is as a result of active efflux of the drug out of the cell. This is at the level of the cytoplasmic membrane. The other mechanism results in decreased binding. This is plasma mediated. And this mechanism involves the following. A plasmid encodes for an RNA methylase. Let's see if I can draw it for you. In this plasmid encoded RNA methylase, Okay? Takes and dimethylates this adenine residue. And the dimethylated adenine residue in the 23S RNA fragment that is the site of binding for the drug at the ribosome, the drug here no longer binds with the same affinity, and as a result, protein synthesis no longer is inhibited. So multiple mechanisms play out, some more prominent in certain microorganisms than in others. So efflux may be important in E. coli. Altered binding may be important in strep pneumoniae. I'm just making those up. The fact is, both of these play to reduce the effectiveness of the macrolide drugs. Well, in terms of the pharmacology, what do we know about the pharmacology of erythromycin? We know that erythromycin is well absorbed from the intestine. Here's the challenge. How do you get it to the intestine intact? And so there have been two strategies, as I alluded to earlier, for producing forms of the drug that are resistant to acid hydrolysis. So one can produce salts or derivatives, so erythromycin acetylate, ethyl succinate, or stearate, are oral forms of the drug that are more resistant to acid degradation. Now, let me just emphasize, more resistant, not absolute. We'll see this in a second. So one strategy has been to overcome the acid lability of the lactone. One way has been to make derivatives, salts, etc. The other way involves the preparation of enteric coated erythromycin. Put erythromycin in an enteric tablet that will degrade, break down as the pH in the intestine increases, releasing the erythromycin in the intestine where it can be absorbed. Both of those strategies have been employed. Once the drug hits the intestine and is absorbed, it is distributed peripherally. It penetrates, it localizes into tissues. You find it in macrophages, you find it in fibroblasts, you find it in leukocytes, etc., and in various tissues. It does not cross the blood-brain barrier. Not only is it localized in tissues, liver being one such tissue, it undergoes some metabolism, and it is eliminated by the bile predominantly. And if you just look, here is a brief summary of the sort of the pharmacology of erythromycin. A salt or an enteric coated tablet gets absorbed. It's got a fairly short half-life. It undergoes metabolism. Most of the metabolites that are produced are eliminated by biliary excretion, only a small amount in the urine. So the question then is, okay, what is the spectrum? How is this drug that now you have administered used clinically? What is the clinical spectrum of erythromycin? And it's summarized here, and then I'll go back to the big picture. But it's used to treat pneumonias. And the pneumonias that it's used to treat are pneumonias caused by chlamydia, by legionella, by mycoplasma, by strep pneumoniae. It is an alternate drug in individual, it has its own activity, but it is also an alternate drug in patients that are hypersensitive to penicillins. And we'll see this beautifully played out in this sort of pie chart here. So erythromycin has activity against chlamydia, chlamydial infections, and indeed chlamydia trachomatis, and provides a good drug for treating urogenital chlamydia trachomatis in a pregnant woman that is hypersensitive to penicillins. It has activity in eliminating the carrier state of diphtheria. All of these drugs, but particularly erythromycin as well as others, have activity against legionella pneumophila that causes about 2 to 3% of pneumonias, but can be tough to detect and then promptly treat. It is effective in the treatment of syphilis, particularly syphilis in an individual that is allergic to penicillin G, which is the drug of choice. And then it also has activity, as we saw with tetracyclines, in the treatment of mycoplasma pneumoniae. So its spectrum is very limited in terms of gram-positive organisms, not effective against methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, but effective against group A strep and strep pneumoniae. Now, if you say, I understand why beta-lactams were not effective against methicillin-resistant staph because they had altered binding sites, what's the mechanism here for macrolides and I might say tetracyclines and almost everything we're going to talk about until late on Wednesday being also ineffective? And the answer is no one really knows. But methicillin-resistant staph that's getting a lot of press in the last few days, methicillin-resistant staph is not only resistant to beta-lactams, it is resistant to multiple antibiotics across multiple classes. So, if we stay with the theme, erythromycin, and then I'll tell you some new entries. The question would be, what are the side effects? What are the adverse effects associated with this drug? And the adverse effects that one sees fall into about three major categories. One is GI upset. The GI upset appears to be, but not exclusively, the result of acid breakdown products of erythromycin. They are irritating to the gastric mucosa. They cause nausea, they can lead to vomiting, and they can lead to diarrhea. And in my house, I have three women, all of whom have this problem. They cannot, my wife nor my children, daughters, can tolerate erythromycin because of its propensity to cause acid breakdown and then GI upset and nausea and vomiting. It is a frequent side effect associated with the drug. And we're going to see that was the driving force to come up with alternate macrolide drugs that didn't have gastric upset as the major side effect. Erythromycin, primarily one of its salts, the estylate salt, can produce cholestatic jaundice. The cholestatic jaundice that one sees appears to be composed of both a toxic effect as well as a hypersensitive effect. The estylate salt decreases bile flow. There is a direct toxic effect on bile production. There is also evidence that the cholestatic jaundice has a hypersensitivity component, and that is an individual that develops the cholestatic jaundice, which occurs typically 10 to 20 days after treatment initiation. If that individual is retreated with erythromycin estylate, the development of the cholestatic jaundice is prompt and immediate. So, in short, the estylate salt is the primary villain. The frequency is low. The toxicity is the result of a direct toxic effect on bile production and has a hypersensitive component. Then there are a number of drug interactions. Yes?
Do many people get the bile flow toxicity reaction?
I'll tell you, the drug that is primarily has been responsible for it is called Ilazone. It's made by a company 50 miles up 37. And it was used primarily in pediatrics, which is where it was seen. The incidence is higher in children than in adults, okay? And the incidence is about, it's well under one in a million treated. But it's fairly significant in a pediatric case. It's more prevalent. It's more severe. Okay. The other area that erythromycin can potentially lead to undesirable effects is as a result of drug-drug interaction. When erythromycin concentrates in the liver and undergoes breakdown or metabolism, the metabolic step involves oxidation. And the oxidation is primarily carried out by an isozyme of cytochrome P450 called cytochrome 3A4. We're going to talk about 3A4 multiple times, okay? It is simply an isozyme of the liver microsomal enzyme system that is involved in oxidations and is a major form of cytochrome involved in the oxidation of many drugs, including erythromycin. Thus, when erythromycin is given in the presence of drugs that are metabolized by the 3A form isozyme, there is the potential for drug-drug interactions. Let me just give you a few examples. You could almost do this generic. But I'll just use theophylline. So you have a patient on theophylline to manage asthma. And now that patient develops an infection and you introduce erythromycin. Erythromycin can inhibit the metabolism of theophylline, increasing its plasma concentration, leading to side effects. You can play that out X, Y, Z, Q, and there's a whole bunch of drugs here, and you need not memorize them. It also can influence the absorption of digoxin. And digoxin, as you know, has a very narrow therapeutic index. So you don't have a lot of play here. And so it is known that erythromycin can result in greater intestinal reabsorption of digoxin. And it does it by eliminating the microflora that ordinarily would inactivate the digoxin such that more is available to be absorbed. Now, I've given you the forward story. That is, erythromycin inhibiting the metabolism of a number of drugs that, like erythromycin, are metabolized by the 3A4 isozyme. The back ass words is also true. There are drugs that are metabolized by the 3A4 isozyme that can interfere with the metabolism of erythromycin. This works both ways. And recently, there was a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that talked about this problem. And this is what the paper showed, and that is, if you mix erythromycin with certain drugs, there is an increased incidence of cardiac arrest. And the cardiac arrest is the result of erythromycin prolonging cardiac repolarization. So this is a dose-dependent effect on erythromycin. And when erythromycin that has this risk of prolonging repolarization is taken along with certain other drugs, both of which are metabolized, or all of which are metabolized by this isozyme, the concentration of erythromycin goes up and leads to increased risk of cardiac arrest. Well, what are these? Calcium channel blockers have been implicated, and a couple important antifungal drugs have been implicated. What they are saying is one needs to be very careful in mixing erythromycin with these antifungals and these calcium channel blockers because they inhibit the metabolism of erythromycin, prolonging its concentration and leading to increased risk of cardiac arrest. Okay. Now, I got so many pieces of paper here, I can't keep it all straight. So it's against that background now that I want to share with you, describe for you, several other macrolides. There are two in a recent entry, but there are two drugs that were introduced in the last 5 to 10 years that have become very useful agents. They are macrolides, so just like erythromycin, and here was the strategy. The strategy was to see if one could make a macrolide that had increased acid stability and, two, might also have an improved clinical spectrum, be more active against susceptible pathogens, maybe even being effective against additional pathogens. There are two of these drugs that have been introduced. I gotta find it, Judas. Aha. There are two of these drugs. I just want to point out what the chemist did. Okay? This is on the house. Okay? One of these drugs is called clarithromycin. You may know it by the term Biaxin. And here's what they did. They simply took at this position 6 in the lactone ring. At this position 6, they replaced this hydrogen with a methyl group. Fairly simple change. So basically, bioxin is a semi-synthetic derivative of erythromycin. And that led to a compound that had greater acid stability and, by translation, less risk, less likelihood of upsetting the GI tract. It also had some interesting properties in terms of spectrum, and then I'll show you its pharmacology. Let me translate this picture for you. Those that are dark, those organisms that are dark, clarithromycin has increased activity against staph and strep greater than that of erythromycin. And if you look here, what you see is bioxin or clarithromycin led to a compound that had increased gram-positive activity. It had activity against Moraxella. It had activity still against pneumophila, but also picked up Haemophilus influenza that was not effectively treated with erythromycin. And I threw this in just as a reminder. It also has activity against Helicobacter pylori, the bug responsible for gastric ulcers. And we're going to see that bioxin later on a week from Wednesday, that bioxin has activity and is used in one of the protocols for the cure of gastric ulcers. It is bioxin along with a proton pump inhibitor. And it's because of its effectiveness against this organism. And then it also has activity against chlamydia. If you look at the pharmacology of this, it's fairly downhill relative to erythromycin. It is orally active, has a slightly longer half-life. Like erythromycin, it undergoes metabolism. The metabolites, many of which possess some antimicrobial activity, and about half is eliminated in the urine, and the other half goes out in the bile. So there's nothing overly remarkable. It also has improved penetration into cells, in particular intracellular, and many of these organisms are intracellular organisms, so the drug has to get inside to pick off chlamydia, to pick off Legionella, etc. So it has sufficient lipid solubility to diffuse and to concentrate intracellularly and be effective against these organisms. And you can see here the bugs that it's effective against. Well, that was one variation on the theme. And that is, could you take the molecule erythromycin and modify it? The other change that came about was to take the ring here, which is made up of 14 members, and splice in, introduce a nitrogen. Make it 15-member ring. And when that was done, the compound that resulted was a compound called azithromycin, or Zithromax. And my guess is you have some familiarity with this. This is the Z-Pak component. This is the drug that has less activity against gram-positive, but relative to erythromycin, much greater activity against Moraxella, Haemophilus, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, becomes a very effective drug in the treatment of pneumonias, upper respiratory tract infections due to these organisms. It also has some interesting pharmacology. And that's why you only pay $60 for 5 tablets in contrast to other drugs. It is orally active. It has greater acid stability, leads to, or does not produce the incidence of upset and nausea that erythromycin. It localizes in tissues, again, macrophages, leukocytes, fibroblasts. It localizes intracellular. It almost forms depot-type deposits in tissues. It has, as a result, a fairly low blood level, but an incredibly long half-life. And if you look, the half-life exceeds about 40 hours. And so you typically take 2 of this drug, 2 pills, and then 3 over the next, or 4 over the next 4 days. And this is as effective as a 10 to 14 day regimen. It's metabolized. Some of the metabolites are active. And most of the drug in metabolites are eliminated in the urine. Clarithromycin and azithromycin are variations on the theme, but here's their limitation. Bugs that become resistant to erythromycin tend to exhibit cross-resistance to clarithromycin and azithromycin. As a result, there is or has been an effort to see if one can overcome it, and I'll just tell you about it before we move to one final subject. This is a drug that got a lot of press recently. It's called telithromycin. It is an erythromycin. Let me see if I can get this higher for you. It is an erythromycin drug that has a slightly different chemical composition, and it's sometimes referred to as a ketolide. It's the first of these erythromycin variants. Here's what its calling card consists of. It is not a substrate for active efflux. So it now becomes a drug that can be used against resistant organisms that are pumping the drug out of the cell. Its spectrum of activity is similar, but it's to erythromycin, its real calling card is its resistance to active efflux. Now, one last thing and we'll call it a day. We've looked at 2 major classes of drugs that work in the cytoplasm to inhibit protein synthesis. There's one other class and then a bunch of strays, and that's going to be the agenda for Wednesday. But I want to introduce the class to you, and then we'll stop. And I want to put this in historic perspective for you. In the 1940s, when penicillin was being identified, isolated, and ultimately became available in the mid to late 40s, one had in hand a drug, and remember this was penicillin G, one had in hand a drug that was effective primarily against gram-positive organisms. There was not a therapeutic agent available effective against gram-negative bacteria. And so major effort was undertaken to see if one could isolate, find a compound or compounds that would be effective against gram-negative bacteria. And a gentleman by the name of Waxman in the very early 40s isolated a strain of Streptomyces, grew it up, demonstrated that it produced in the media a substance that was effective against gram-negative bacteria. Since the substance was derived from a strain of Streptomyces, he named his compound streptomycin, which is one of a class of compounds that are known as aminoglycosides. He received the Nobel Prize, as did Fleming, as did the group at Oxford for the work on penicillin. And now one had a drug for the first time that was effective against gram-negative bacteria, nosocomial infections. And for many years, streptomycin and the aminoglycosides had extensive use clinically. However, we will see that these drugs come with a lot of baggage. They have a number of very severe side effects affecting the inner ear and affecting the kidneys. As a result of that baggage, and with the emergence, more recently, of third generation cephalosporins that had that increased activity, and the emergence of a class of drugs that you will be taught shortly called fluoroquinolones that have that gram-negative spectrum of activity, both cephalosporins and fluoroquinolones lack the baggage found with aminoglycosides. And so what has happened is their use has diminished significantly over time. They still have limited but valuable clinical utility. And the clinical utility is aimed at aerobic gram-negative bacteria. And the criteria for the presence of oxygen is the result or results from the fact that the susceptible organisms actively transport the aminoglycoside into the cytoplasm, and that active process is oxygen dependent. Now there are several of these two that I want to dispose of today, and then we'll be set up for Wednesday. The first of these drugs that was isolated was a substance called streptomycin. Its use currently is very limited. It's used to treat plague, which is caused by Yersinia pestis. This is not an unknown disease, by the way. It is used to treat tularemia, which is acquired primarily from rabbits. And it is an alternative drug in the treatment of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. Here's the problem. The problem is all of these drugs have to be given by injection. Now, you're treating somebody for Mycobacterium tuberculosis that's multi-drug resistant. Getting that patient to the clinic to receive a shot day after day after day for weeks, for months, maybe beyond, is exceedingly difficult. So streptomycin has limited clinical utility. Then there's another aminoglycoside that we also use. Its use is limited. This is neomycin. Neomycin is too toxic to be used systemically, but is used topically. And so you see neomycin along with bacitracin and polymyxin B in various topical ointments and salves and creams and lotions and drops to provide gram-negative spectrum. When these topical preps are used, In some patients, hypersensitivity develops. And these polydrug preparations that contain neomycin, it is the neomycin that most commonly, most frequently, is responsible for the hypersensitivity topically. The vast majority of people tolerate triple antibiotic preparations for scrapes, etc. So neomycin's use also is limited. So now we're down to two or three compounds, and the place we will begin on Wednesday is simply picking one of these, a compound gentamicin, okay, and looking at its pharmacology, etc. All of these compounds are made up of amino-containing sugars. All are highly water-soluble. All are basic, which means they're going to be protonated, positively charged under physiological conditions. And that plays out. And all are composed of sugars and amino sugars connected by glycosidic linkages. And that's where we'll pick up the story on Wednesday at 8:05.
Can I take a look at the
Journal of Medicine
slide?
Sure, sure, sure. Here.